Romans 11, verses 1 to 15. I ask then, did God reject his people? By no means. I am an Israelite myself, a descendant of Abraham from the tribe of Benjamin. God did not reject his people whom he foreknew. Don't you know what scripture says in the passage about Elijah, how he appealed to God against Israel? Lord, they have killed your prophets and torn down your altars. I am the only one left, and they're trying to kill me. And what was God's answer to him? I have reserved for myself 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So too, at the present time, there is a remnant chosen by grace. And if by grace, then it cannot be based on works. If it were, grace would no longer be grace. What then? What the people of Israel sought so earnestly, they did not obtain. The elect among them did, but the others were hardened. As it is written, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that could not see, and ears that could not hear, to this very day. And David says, may their table become a snare and a trap, a stumbling block and a retribution for them. May their eyes be darkened so they cannot see, and their backs be bent forever. Again I ask, did they stumble so as to fall beyond recovery? Not at all. Rather, because of their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles to make Israel envious. But if their transgression means riches for the world, and their loss means riches for the Gentiles, how much greater riches will their full inclusion bring? I'm talking to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am the apostle to the Gentiles. I take pride in my ministry, in the hope that I may somehow arouse my own people to envy and save some of them. For if their rejection brought reconciliation to the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? If the part of the dough offered as first fruits is holy, then the whole batch is holy. If the root is holy, so are the branches. Now, quite all of that today, or certainly we'll look mostly at verses 1 to 10, a little bit verses 11 to 15, just to kind of complete the picture. But we'll come back to it, God willing, next week. But to get us thinking about this subject of the place of Israel in God's purposes, I've got some statements here. I want you to think in your mind, true or false. Okay, true or false. All Jewish people across the world today are God's people. True or false. The modern state of Israel is God's chosen nation. They are his people. True or false. The church, made up of Jewish and Gentile Christians, is God's people. True or false. One day, all Israelites will be saved, even if they don't believe in Jesus. I suspect there might be different answers that people come up to those statements of whether they're true or false. Certainly, there is a wide variety of opinion when it comes to the people of Israel. Are they still God's people? What place do they have? And actually, what Christians believe on this matters. It's great having Matthias and family with us again. If you're an American, voting in America, your vote may well affect American policy towards the state of Israel. Is the state of Israel to be given special status if they're God's chosen nation? Or are they to be treated like any other nation? And for Paul, there was good reason for him to address the place of Israel in God's plan. Jewish leaders often accused him of being against his own fellow countrymen, of being against the law of Moses. And certainly one way of looking at Romans is to see this as Paul's answer to his Jewish critics. I mean, it's actually such a big letter that Paul probably had several aims as he was writing it, but that does seem to be one of them. Even Jewish Christians seemed suspicious of Paul and his ministry amongst the Gentiles. We know this. If you just turn on to chapter 15 and verse 31. Paul is on his way to Jerusalem. He probably wrote the book of Romans when he was in Corinth on his missionary journeys. And he's on his way to Jerusalem bringing a gift from Gentile churches to the Christians, the Jewish Christians in Judea. Now, I don't know about you, but if someone brings me a gift, I'm really happy. But look at what Paul says in verse 31 of chapter 15. Pray that I may be kept safe from the unbelievers in Judea, and that the contribution I take to Jerusalem may be favorably received by the Lord's people there, or literally by the saints there. Seems an odd prayer. You know, I can't imagine anyone praying that I would be graciously receptive of any gift that they give to me. You know, unless it's a budgie, like Ben once gave me, a noisy budgie. So it's an odd prayer, isn't it? Praying that this contribution would be favorably indicates that there was this suspicion about Paul and his ministry to the Gentiles. And here are Gentile believers giving this gift to Jewish Christians in Jerusalem. Then, of course, there's Paul's deep concern for his own countrymen. We've seen that from the beginning of chapter 9, how he has unceasing anguish of heart that they should be saved. For the church in Rome, which, as I've said before, is majority Gentile, we'll see when we come later in chapter 11 how they need to relate to Jewish Christians in a better way. And so it's important for them to understand the place of Israel in God's plans. But how about for us here at MNC? As far as I'm aware, none of us is Jewish, and we don't have so much relating with Jewish people. But we do support evangelism of the Jewish community in London as we support Philip and pray for him. And there are some people who would say this is wrong. The Roman Catholic Church doesn't really agree with evangelism of Jewish people. Shouldn't Jewish people be left to worship God in their way? After all, they use the Old Testament, God's word. Is it right for us to support a missionary to Jewish people? On the other hand, there might be others who wonder, well, you know, is this part of some Christian Zionist agenda? That we support a missionary to Jewish people. Well, I'm not going to answer all these questions today, but Romans is an important book, a chapter, when it comes to thinking about the place of Israelites. And these first 10 verses, and we're going to verse 15 as well, really make the point that God has not rejected his people Israel. I ask then, verse 1, did God reject his people? By no means. I am an Israelite myself, a descendant of Abraham from the tribe of Benjamin. Very clear. But what does it mean? That's what we want to tease out over these next few weeks. So, I have three headings. And again, I apologize that I've not had time to do treasure hunters. But if you are taking notes, I'll give you time to put this first one down, which is, God has kept a remnant of Israelites. God has kept a remnant of Israelites. From the very beginning of Israel as a nation, as they were brought out of Egypt by the prophet Moses, led through the wilderness into the promised land, from the very beginning, Israel frequently turned to idols. They built the golden calf, worshipped that, having not long been rescued by God from Egypt, crossing the Red Sea. Throughout the Old Testament, the pattern of Israel's behavior is one of rejecting God. And God sent prophet after prophet to call the people back. The vast majority of prophecies in the Old Testament are aimed at calling the people of Israel back to God. And yet, as we saw last week, God was holding out his hand to an obstinate people. All day long, I have held out my hands to a disobedient and obstinate people. Last verse of chapter 10. And then the Messiah was born. Starting to put Christmas things in the shops. We're reminded of when the wise men came to Jerusalem. All Jerusalem was troubled. Herod tried to kill this newborn king of the Jews. And in the end, 33 years later, that's exactly what they did. Jerusalem killed him. Well, might we ask then, as Paul does in verse 1 here, did God reject his people? They certainly deserved it. All their history has been one of idolatry, and they crown it all by killing the Messiah. Is that it for Israel? And yet the answer is a clear no. Did God reject his people? By no means. I am an Israelite myself, says Paul, a descendant of Abraham from the tribe of Benjamin. Now, in saying that he is an Israelite, Paul could be saying, I hope not. I hope God hasn't rejected his people because I don't want to be rejected. Probably, though it's not certain. He's saying, rather, God hasn't rejected all his people because look at me. He saved me. And look at what I did. I was a persecutor of the church. I had Christians imprisoned, even put to death. But God saved me. He hasn't rejected all Israelites. Certainly that point is made in the next few verses as Paul talks about the remnant. Not all of Israel was rejected. There was a remnant. And he uses the example from Elijah's day. Elijah was that prophet, great powerful prophet in the time of King Ahab. And Ahab and his wife Jezebel were wicked rulers of Israel. And they turned the hearts of people to following and worshipping Baal. And at one point, Elijah is just so depressed and distraught. And he feels, as his life has been threatened by Queen Jezebel, I'm the only one left. And it's that incident that Paul picks up on in these verses. He appeals to Israel. Then verse 3, Lord, they have killed your prophets and torn down your altars. I am the only one left, and they're trying to kill me. But what's the reply? I have reserved for myself 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. There was a remnant, even at that low point in Israel's history. Just as then, so in Paul's day, there was a remnant who believed. Verse 5, so too at the present time, there is a remnant chosen by grace. This believing remnant was evidence of God's ongoing concern for Israel as a whole. Though most Jews rejected Christ, Paul insists that God had not rejected them. The wayward son is still welcome to come back, if you remember the illustration from last week. And one day, he will, if you just look on to verse 26. In this way, all Israel will be saved. Now, we'll need to see what that means. But this indication that there will be a turning back to God on the part of at least many in Israel. God, as the sovereign Lord, chose Israel as a nation for particular blessing. We know the Old Testament history. The scriptures insist that this was God's free choice. And notice in these first 6 verses the emphasis on God's sovereignty. He foreknew his people. Verse 2, God did not reject his people whom he foreknew. God knows all that's going to happen. How does God know everything that's going to happen? It's the only way you can know what's going to happen is if you determine it. I've made this point many times. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You may have a good idea, but you do not know for sure because you do not determine what happens. God alone determines things, and therefore God knows. He foreknew his people. And so not even their worst rejection is going to change his plan. God, in his sovereignty, reserved 7,000 for himself. Verse 4, this was God's doing. It wasn't the people's efforts. And then verse 5, he chose these people, and it was on the basis of his grace, not on their works. Look at the emphasis in verse 6. And if by grace, then it cannot be based on works. If it were, grace would no longer be grace. God in his sovereignty chose the people of Israel to be his particular people. The scriptures insist this was God's free choice. He foreknew them. He doesn't reject them. And so for the remnant to be chosen by grace, it is God's free choice. And I think we should just pause for a moment here and marvel at the grace of God. Israel was not a deserving nation. It's so obvious as you read through the Old Testament and then as you read what they did to Jesus in the pages of the New Testament. Look at whom God chooses to show mercy to. A nation rebellious, one that killed his son. Paul the apostle who had persecuted Christians. And Jesus, as he meets him on the road to Damascus, has to say, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And yet the Lord has mercy on that man Saul, also known as Paul. And what a wonder that we too as Gentiles have been saved. Whenever we think of the mercy and the grace of God, we need to marvel. We need to glory and praise God. It's not those who try hard, who think that they can earn salvation. No, it's by God's grace, always God's grace. Salvation is not like an exam at school. You've got to work hard for your exams. You earn that result. Or maybe you're training to be part of a team. It's your effort that does it. It's not like that with salvation. Salvation is God's gift. If by grace, it cannot be based on works. If it were, grace would no longer be grace. And every day I am so thankful to God that it does not depend on my performance, but on grace. Is that what makes you rejoice? As you think about heaven, as you think about God's salvation, as you think about grace, does your heart rejoice that this is something given to you, that you receive by faith, not through your efforts? Well, we've seen this first heading. God has cut of Israel. He does so by his grace. Now the second heading. God has hardened the rest of the Israelites. That's our second heading. God has hardened the rest of the Israelites. We've seen that saving a remnant of Israelites shows that God has not rejected his people. He still is concerned for them. They've not, as in totality, been cast out. But what about the rest? Well, look at verse 7. There are three groups of people here. What then? The people of Israel sought so earnestly, they did not obtain. The elect among them did, but the others were hardened. So you have the people of Israel here, the ones who sought so earnestly something. They sought righteousness, as we've seen from chapters, the end of chapter 9 and into chapter 10. They sought this righteousness. They tried to be righteous. How? Through obeying the law. We're back at chapter 9, verse 31. But the people of Israel who pursued the law as the way of righteousness have not attained their goal. Then in this verse we have the elect. That means the chosen one. If you go to this school, you have electives after school. They're things that you elect to do, you choose to do. The elect are those who are chosen. These are the remnant, Jews who have been chosen by God's grace. People like Paul, who put their faith as Jewish people in their Messiah, Jesus Christ. And then in this verse, we have the rest. You see what happens to them? The elect, they obtained this righteousness through faith, but the others, the rest of them, were hardened. And to reinforce this point that the rest of the Israelites were hardened, we have two quotes from the Old Testament. Firstly, here in verse 8, as it is written, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that could not see, and ears that could not hear, to this very day. This is a quote from Deuteronomy 29 and verse 4. And Deuteronomy was what Moses taught the people just before they went into the promised land. They'd been wandering for 40 years in the wilderness, having come out of Egypt. They're about to go into the land that God is giving them. And as we come to the end of Deuteronomy, chapter 29, and the next couple of chapters, is Moses' final speech to them. And he reviews their history. And he shows that from the outset, the people of Israel really did not see. They didn't have spiritual eyes to see. Because they had witnessed this miraculous rescue from Egypt. Remember the story of the 10 plagues, the crossing of the Red Sea? They had seen this utterly astonishing, never before rescue from slavery and formation miraculously of a new nation. But they just didn't grasp the power of God, the mercy of God, the grace of God. They just didn't see. Another thing this passage in Deuteronomy 29 reminds the people of is that every day they ate manna, food that just appeared for them on the ground. Every day they experienced this miracle. I mean, you know, maybe you think it's a miracle. You go to the fridge and there's food for you. Well, your parents have provided that food. They put it in there. And we're very thankful to those who do the shopping and etc. But imagine going outside into your garden and just on the ground, there's all this wonderful food that you can eat every day. They got so used to it, they didn't see that it was from God. It was a miracle. Or the clothes that they wore. I mean, it's great to wear things that are old and so on, but eventually they do wear out, don't they? Hands up if you've got any item of clothing you've worn every day for 40 years and it's still in pristine condition. That was the case for all of the Israelites. And their shoes didn't wear out. Or sandals. That's not because they were really good at making sandals in those days. It was a miracle. It didn't wear out. But they didn't click. The people didn't realize. Even though they could see it every day, they put these sandals on, this clothing on every day, and still it was pristine. They just didn't see. Why? God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that could not see, and ears that could not hear to this very day. Do you know, they were just like the Pharisees in Jesus' day. It never ceases to amaze me how the Pharisees could talk about the miracles Jesus did. They even acknowledged that, yes, Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead. Surely they can see Jesus must be from God. Surely they could see that at least he's a prophet from heaven. Someone with God's approval that he can raise the dead, do these wonderful things. They could see the miracles were true, but what do they do with Jesus? Having acknowledged that miraculous raising of Lazarus, they plot to kill Jesus. That's blindness. That is spiritual blindness. Their hearts have been hardened. The second Old Testament quote to reinforce this point that God hardened their hearts comes in verses 9 and 10. And this is a quotation from Psalm 69. We didn't get as far as these verses, but I read the earlier part. Let me read verses 9 and 10 here. And David says, may there take a trap, a stumbling block and a retribution for them. May their eyes be darkened so they cannot see and their backs be bent forever. David here is praying that his enemies would be confounded. David was at a low ebb. He felt he was sinking in the mire under all the pressure of these hostile enemies. And he prays that God would bring them down. As I mentioned before reading the beginning of those verses from Psalm 69 at the beginning of the service, this psalm prophesies the way in which Jesus would be treated. You have that verse about drinking gall and being given vinegar for his thirst. That's what happened on the cross. And reference is made to Psalm 69, that this prophecy was being fulfilled. And now Paul, as he writes Romans 11, he applies David's prayer in these verses to the Jews who were resisting the gospel. The Jews killed Jesus on the cross, fulfilling Psalm 69. And now Paul takes the prayer of David, may their table become a snare, a stumbling block and a refuge. May their eyes be darkened so they cannot see. And this is what happened to Israel. They simply couldn't see what they were doing. They're in the process of fulfilling those psalms. They even quote some of the psalms. He saved others. Let him save himself. And they don't see that they're in the process of fulfilling those prophecies that the Messiah would be killed. Their eyes have been darkened. God gave Israel darkened eyes that could not see. They could not hear. They thought they could be righteous by obeying the law and didn't need Jesus. They were putting their faith in themselves. And this is the big danger of religion. Because religion says, if you can do these things, follow these rituals, obey these rules, then maybe God will accept you. And it promotes pride. It's saying, if you try hard enough, you can do it. And it leaves people thinking, yeah, I can do it. That's pride. Religion promotes pride and self-sufficiency. It doesn't promote humility and trust. God resists the proud. He hardens their hearts. And you end up with eyes that cannot see. Now just look around. Think about the world today. It is full of people who simply do not have eyes to see. We saw last week that the heavens declare the glory of God. Every star, every planet created by God and in its vast splendor is declaring the glory of God. God is saying, I created this vast, vast universe. And people are blind to it. They're willing to believe that it all came from some random Big Bang. And they don't stop to think, well, where did that come from? It's blindness. Though the heavens are declaring the glory of God, so many people are unwilling to accept that he even exists. Or think of the way people try and solve their problems. Surely if they knew any history, surely if they just examined their own life, they would see that human solutions just aren't working. I mean, we know the problems facing Britain and so many countries today, the economic problems, the social problems, the drug problem, so many problems, crime, breakdown of families, all these things, we could make an endless list. Where do people go for solutions? Well, let's keep depending on human solutions. It doesn't work. There's a blindness that comes from thinking that you can sort yourself out. And this is what happened to Israel. They were blind. They thought they could sort themselves out spiritually by following God's law. Nothing against God's law. But they were incapable of obeying it. They thought they could do it. I wonder this morning, do you think you can sort your life out? Do you think that with your wisdom, you can sort things out? The problems that you face, the problems that you will face, you can sort it out. Or are you willing to cry to God for mercy, for help, for his wisdom? Don't be one of those whose hearts is hardened. like the rest of these Israelites. Now, because we'll consider this in more detail, but it just gives a fuller picture as we answer this question of trying to understand more of what it means that God has not rejected his people Israel. We've firstly seen he has kept a remnant, and that shows that he's still concerned for his people Israel. We've seen that he's hardened the rest of Israelites. But then the third point, God has saved Gentiles to turn Israelites back to him. God has saved Gentiles to turn Israelites back to him. This next section from verse 11 begins with another question and another firm denial. Again, I ask, did they, that is the people of Israel, did they stumble so as to fall beyond recovery? Not at all. The rejection of Israel was not total. There was a remnant. The rejection of Israel was not final. They will return. Rest of verse 11. Not at all. Rather, because of their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles to make Israel envious. But if their transgression means riches for the world, and their loss means riches for the Gentiles, how much greater riches will their full inclusion bring? Now we saw back in chapter 10 and verse 19 that God's plan was to make Israel envious by those who are not a nation. Let me read again, chapter 10, verse 19. Again, I asked, did Israel not understand? First, Moses says, I will make you envious by those who are not a nation. This is spelled out more in detail now from verse 11. God's plan was that Israel, having rejected their Messiah, only a remnant believing, God would make the rest of Israel envious. How? By giving salvation to Gentiles. Remember the illustration I used last week? About a child takes a toy out of a cupboard. That toy's been in that cupboard for weeks and weeks, never played with. The moment the child takes it out of the cupboard, starts playing with it, the sibling says, I want that toy. Yeah? It's human nature. God is saving Gentiles to provoke Israelites to envy. Because of their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles to make Israel envious. Now, please don't misunderstand me if I use this illustration. I don't spend ages trying to work out the intricacies of the royal family and what's going on. I don't watch The Crown, and apparently it's not factual always anyway. So that's the kind of disclaimer. But Prince Harry is publishing his memoirs. Does anyone know the title to this book, which apparently will come out, I think, in December, maybe in time for Christmas? Spare. And the reason he's calling it Spare is because there's this phrase amongst the nobility, the heir and the spare. And so if you had a massive inheritance to pass on, you'd want to make sure that you had, in those days, a son. And, well, what if something happened? So you'd want to have a second son, a spare. Now, if you're that second son, Prince Harry, you could spend all your life feeling grumpy that, well, you're not really wanted. You're only there just in case. You're spare. Of course, one hopes the parents do not treat the second son like that. They love and appreciate the son for who he is, and etc., etc. So all those of you who are second sons or second daughters, please feel reassured. But there's something of an illustration there as we look at this verse. Because of salvation has come to the Gentiles to make Israel envious. Now, again, do not misunderstand this. God is a loving parent. He's not a parent who distinguishes between his children in that sense. God loves us as Gentile believers. He has saved us in his love. But there is also this purpose in saving Gentiles. It's to provoke Israelites to turn to Christ. Which actually, in turn, will lead to further blessing for Gentiles. Verse 12. If Israel's loss means riches for the Gentiles, you know, the Jews reject, that's what happens, isn't it? When Paul went on his missionary journeys, he started where? In the synagogue. Almost every time he'd start in the synagogue. If there wasn't a synagogue, like in Philippi, he met with the Jewish women who were met for prayer. Evidently, weren't enough Jewish men to form a synagogue. He needed 10 men in a place to start a synagogue. There weren't enough in Philippi. Paul still goes to the Jews first. But when they reject the message, he then turns to the Gentiles. And Paul's whole process was not to reject his fellow countrymen, but was aiming at prodding them, provoking them to believe. So verse 13, I'm talking to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am the apostle to the Gentiles. I take pride in my ministry in the hope that I may somehow arouse my own people to envy and save some of them. For if their rejection brought reconciliation to the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? Now, we'll consider these things a bit more next week. I just wanted to complete the picture. One reason God's salvation is reaching the ends of the world is to the people of Israel to be envious. God will draw Israelites back to himself. How and when? I'm not sure we can say with clarity, but we'll consider more of these things later. For now, we can see that actually Paul is answering his critics. Those Jewish leaders in Jerusalem who said Paul had just abandoned Moses and his own people Israel. No. Paul's very mission to the Gentiles has this underlying purpose. More next week. What does this full inclusion of Israel mean? How does it enrich Gentiles? But for now, let's just wonder at the grace of God, that God has this plan that spans the centuries, and it's a plan of grace. However we understand these verses, we can see that there is God showing grace, God bringing blessing, God's love and concern for both Jew and Gentile. We may not all come to the same final conclusion to those statements I made at the beginning, but I think we can all see so wonderfully that God has a plan, and it's a plan of grace. And so I want to encourage you, don't be one of those people who are hardened. Call upon the Lord. Receive his grace. Don't be like those Israelites who are hardened, who are trying to sort out their lives for themselves and didn't cry to God. Do you need help today? Do you need forgiveness? Do you need your shame taken away? Don't try and sort it out yourself. Come to God. Cry to him, your creator, who loves you, Jew and Gentile, who loves us and will help us as we turn to him. Let's pray.